This is May 4th, 2014, and I'm going to read from and comment on an article that someone left on my desk from the New York Times opinion pages. The name of the article is What Does Buddhism Require? And this is part of a forum for contemporary philosophers and other thinkers on issues both timely and timeless. It's called The Stone. And this is a fifth in a series of interviews about religion conducted by Gary Gutting, who is a professor of philosophy at Notre Dame. And this, Professor Gutting is interviewing a Jay Garfield, who we're told here has taught philosophy at several universities and is currently teaching in Singapore at Yale NUS College. And he's at work on a book called Engaging Buddhism, Why Buddhism Matters to Contemporary Philosophy. I hope this article will be helpful to newer people especially, but even people who've been practicing longer, who've heard teishos and read about Buddhist doctrine, it maybe can clarify some little misunderstandings, perhaps. What I like about it, one of the things I like about it, is it steps back and looks at the big picture. I suppose in any tradition or a sect like Zen, there's always some danger of our becoming too provincial in our outlook and losing sight of this bigger tradition that we're part of called Buddhism. So he starts off one professor asking the other, philosophy of religion typically focuses on questions and disputes about the ideas and doctrines of monotheistic religions, with Christianity the primary model. How does the discussion change if we add Buddhism, which is neither monotheistic nor polytheistic, as a primary model of a religion? So he's asking, it's Buddhism neither asserts that there is a single God, nor that there are multiple gods. And now this Professor Garfield. What gets called philosophy of religion in most philosophy departments and journals is really the philosophy of Abrahamic religion, basically Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. That's what Abraham, those are the Abrahamic religions, the ones that are about 99% of people who are religious in the West are Jews, Christians, or Muslims. Most of the questions addressed in those discussions are simply irrelevant to most of the world's other religious traditions. Philosophers look at other religious traditions with the presumption that they are more or less the same as the Abrahamic religions, and even fight about whether other traditions count as religions at all based upon their sharing certain features of the Abrahamic religions. That is a serious ethnocentrism that can really blind us to important phenomena. Whenever I've been asked at introductory workshops or elsewhere about whether Zen is a religion, what I say is it depends on how you define religion. If you think of religion as requiring a divine being, a creator God who is omniscient and omnipotent and omnipresent, then no, Zen isn't a religion. Buddhism isn't a religion. There's no acceptance of God as an agent. In Buddhism, there's no such thing. In Zen, there's no such thing as thinking of God as an entity or someone who has agency, who can change things or do things. But if you think of Zen, if you think of religion as resting on faith, then yes, Zen is a religion in that sense. It's just not an Abrahamic religion. But let's let him talk. For instance, I recently moderated a discussion in Singapore with the philosopher A.C. Grayling, who claimed that Buddhism is not a religion because Buddhists don't believe in a supreme being. This simply ignores the fact that many religions are not theistic in this sense. Chess is a game, despite the fact that it is not played with a ball. Now, and then he urges caution. I have to do some skipping, as usual, skipping through some of these paragraphs because the article's too long. He just steps back and says, now, let's remember, Buddhism is a vast, the Buddhist world is vast, and it's been around for 2.5 millennia. There are many forms of Buddhist practice and culture, different communities, and so generalization can be dangerous. And this is another thing to really keep in mind. There are such a variety of teachings and practices in Buddhism. It's really tremendous, tremendous variety. We have to be very careful about making any assertions about what Buddhism is. Because what we might consider Buddhism in this country is might not be at all the same as some other country. But then with that qualification, he says, still there are some widely shared features of Buddhism that would make a philosophy of religion that took it seriously look quite different. First, since Buddhism is an atheistic religion, that's me applying the brakes. I've never read this before from someone informed about Buddhism that it's atheistic. Just to check myself on this, I grabbed the dictionary this morning and looked up atheism, and it says it denies the existence of God. It asserts there is no God. Well, the first problem with that is what we were just talking about. Depends on how you define God. A more sophisticated understanding of God is not that it's an agent. Certainly an old man up in the sky with a long gray beard and gray hair and so forth. No, but it's it, nowhere that I've ever heard of is it said that Buddhism denies the existence of God. It doesn't claim that there is any particular God figure or creator God, but it doesn't deny the existence of a God because that would be a claim to know something that we can't know. How do we know whether there's a God, and whatever you mean by God? Buddhism is much more subtle and sophisticated than to say there is no God. The most I think we can say is what I already said, is that there's no creator God. Or in an article, a Time magazine article once, Roshi Kaplow was interviewed, and I really liked what he said. He said there is no God concept in Zen. So this is the one thing that really surprised me about this article, that this guy who has a very finely developed understanding of Buddhist doctrine, I don't know if he has any experience practicing, but he's got good sense of the doctrine of it, that he would say that Buddhism is an atheistic religion. So, but he does say it doesn't raise questions about the existence of God that so dominate the philosophy of Abrahamic religions, let alone questions about the attributes of the deity. This always amazes me that people can argue and discuss about, well, okay, whether there's a God, all right, but his attributes? I guess if you don't buy that there is any kind of creator God, it's hard to get past that into attributes. And then he says, Buddhists do worry about awakening. Do we? all right, not to be too critical. Let's say that it's a concern. It's a focus of some Buddhists about awakening to our true nature. Fair enough, but not worrying. I see the word worry, and I think of furrows in your brow. So let's just change that just for a minute, give them the benefit of the doubt. Buddhists do think about awakening, are concerned about awakening. How hard is it to achieve? What is it like? I think that's true. And then he says, is a Buddha aware of her surroundings, or do they disappear as illusory? I like that he uses the feminine word here, her. Is a Buddha aware of her surroundings? Because the real Buddha is beyond him or her. Just along the same line, he continues, Buddhists also worry about the relation between ordinary reality or conventional truth and ultimate reality. For those of you who are brand new, this is sort of describes what is sometimes called the twofold truth of the Dharma, which is that it can always that the full truth can be seen from two sides. One is this so-called conventional world, the world of phenomena, of things, and all the measures of things and gain and loss and success and failure and right and wrong and good and bad and all those things, evolution and devolution, all the things that most people think of as reality. There's that, and then there's the other side, which is what is beyond all that. Conventional reality talks about time and space and change. The other side, the back side, is beyond time and space and change. And what Zen teaches, and this is confirmed through awakening, is that you can't separate these two. They're just two different ways of dividing what is really indivisible. It's the classic analogy is like a coin. We can take a quarter, and we can look at one side and see heads. All right. We look at the other side, tails. That's different. We can talk about heads and tails, but in reality, there's just the coin, the whole coin. The thing, that's the real thing. The rest are just designations. So, again, Buddhists worry about the relation between ordinary reality and ultimate reality. Are they the same or different? So here's a little coaching for if you ever get yourself caught in a philosophical discussion with someone and they ask you that question, are the two, conventional reality or the world of phenomena, is that the same or different from the other world that is beyond all that? And the surely safe answer is they're neither the same nor different. Don't let people box you into that binary kind of trap. It's the same. They're neither the same nor different. When we look at that quarter, we definitely have to acknowledge that heads are heads and tails are tails. When you flip a coin, that's very obvious. You can't conflate the two. If you're distinguishing, but then you can't say they're different either because they are one coin. Are they the same or different? Is the world fundamentally illusory or is it real? Same thing. It's neither illusory nor real. That's better than saying it's both illusory and real. It's neither just illusory or just real. Anyway, what does real mean? That's another slippery word that you can discuss all day, what that means. This goes all the way back to the Buddha, where one of his most profound short statements was, not this, not that. This isn't just cleverness. This isn't just agility in a debate. This is the truth. It's not just that, and it's not just that. Oh, then what is it? Many of the masters would shout out in these dialogues, some of them became koans, they would say, just this. Oh, if you say, wait a minute, you just said not this, not that, now they say just this, then your logical mind is getting the better of you. And back to the interviewer, given these widely shared features, would you venture to say what overall it is to be a Buddhist? And then he says, to be a Buddhist is to take refuge in the three Buddhist refuge objects, the three treasures, or the three jewels, Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. Okay, most of you know this. Whenever I talk about Jukai, taking the precepts, which, by the way, is coming up later this month, I'll talk about that as the single best way. If you need a definition of Buddhism or a Buddhist, you don't really, but then that's probably the best way. Is one who has taken refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then the way he defines that is interesting. It's worth commenting on. He says the first treasure is the Buddha. The fact that at least one person, the historical Buddha Siddhartha Gautama, has achieved awakening and release from suffering. This provides hope in one's future awakening, hope that through practice one can achieve a satisfactory existence. Now, this understanding of the first of the three jewels, Buddha, may have a lot of historical precedent to it, but it's too limited. For us in Zen, it's too limited to see when we take refuge in Buddha that we're placing our faith in that person who lived in India so long ago. In a way, okay, it's fair enough, but better is to understand that as that we're taking refuge or placing our faith. That's what refuge means. We're placing our faith in our own Buddha nature and the Buddha nature of all beings. Now, his interpretation of taking refuge in Buddha is a, what's good about it is it's a practical interpretation of it. If we believe that the Buddha came to perfect enlightenment, then it can fortify our faith that we can also. If he can do it, then we can. So that's all right. It's down to earth. It can fortify our faith and the possibility of awakening. But it is, I think, just a bit limited to see Buddha as just the word Buddha just means enlightened or the enlightened one. But the enlightened one isn't just Siddhartha, Gautama. It's in essence, it's all, every single one of us. Every one of us who's hearing this talk and everyone who's not hearing this talk is fundamentally Buddha in our true nature. And then he kind of skips over the second one. The second refuge is Dharma or Buddhist doctrine. There too, it's a pretty limited understanding of the word Dharma. A fuller understanding of Dharma is the law or the truth or the way. The way is a most common translation of the Chinese word Tao, T-A-O, the Tao. And then the third, he says, is the Sangha or spiritual community, conceived sometimes as the community of other practitioners, sometimes as the community of monks and nuns, sometimes as the community of awakened beings, or we would say Buddhas. And then just to comment, he comments on that, those three ways of understanding this spiritual community. He says, the project of full awakening is a collective, not an individual venture. This is a very important point. Because as Americans, we would tend to interpret everything in terms of the individual self. That's our very deep conditioning, that I'm going to come to awakening or I am not going to come to awakening. It's all about the I and the me and the my. But that's our own spin on it. It's a delusive way of understanding awakening. This is an important point he makes. The project of full awakening is a collective venture, working together, even if we're not in the same state. This Sangha extends everywhere, and we support one another. Whenever we sit, or whenever we're free of thoughts, clinging to thoughts. And then I'm going to skip a couple of questions that get pretty philosophical. And then the interviewer asks about metaphysical insight, the truth about reality, that shows the way to eliminating suffering. And what's his name? Garfield. Professor Garfield says, Buddhist doctrine regarding the nature of reality generally focuses on three principal characteristics of things. And just to review this, because this is one of the more important features of Buddhist doctrine. Sometimes it's called the three characteristics of existence. There are three characteristics of things. The first idea is that all phenomena are impermanent and constantly changing, despite the fact that we engage with them as though they are permanent. The second is that they are interdependent, although we engage with them as though they are independent. The third is that they are without any intrinsic identity, although we treat ourselves and other objects as though they have intrinsic identities. So in briefer terms, the three characteristics of existence is change, or impermanence, impermanence, suffering, and no self. He says here for the second one as is interdependence. Well, certainly, if you deny the interdependence of things, it's one cause of suffering. But I've not seen this. Maybe I've missed something in my Buddhist education, but I haven't seen interdependence as one of the three characteristics of existence. I mean, it is, but it's not the usual listing that I've seen. It's suffering is the third one. And then he makes a point here that I just bracketed one sentence that relates to something earlier, where the great variety of Buddhist practice. He says, in Buddhism, as in Christianity, for many lay people, the religion is about daily rituals and practices, and doctrine is left to scholars and clerics. This is one of the things that's surprising after we've been here, practicing Zen here, is to go to Asia and see that publicly, at least, it does seem that predominantly most people are engaging in their Buddhist religion through rituals, such as it was very common in when I was in I can't remember, Singapore, Hong Kong, certainly China for sure, of groups of obviously devout Buddhists, mostly women, going to the temple and burning incense, but not just incense, like a stick of incense, but bundles of incense, clouds of incense smoke at these places, and this was seemed to be the most visible form of practice. And then the interviewer raises the question of what he first calls reincarnation. He says, you haven't mentioned what to many outsiders might seem the most striking Buddhist doctrine, reincarnation. Yeah, it does. I've gathered over the years that for some people, Buddhism, the first thing their mind goes to when they hear you're a Buddhist is that you believe in reincarnation, which is utterly bizarre to them. Just read a little bit about what he says here. This professor, what is his name? Garfield, says, yes, given the radical Buddhist notion of momentary impermanence, that is, that everything is in flux, moment by moment, we can say without exaggeration, the one is reborn every moment. Buddhism is an Indian tradition, it's true, it comes from India, originated there. And rebirth across biological lives, that's a very nice way of talking about what most people think about with rebirth, is taken for granted in most classical Indian philosophical and religious traditions. Oh, I meant to mention here that this Professor Garfield corrects him about reincarnation being Buddhist. It may seem like a small thing, but I don't think it is, that reincarnation implies the rebirth of a soul. It implies a soul. And in Buddhism, there is no soul. We don't believe that there's anything permanent. And by the way, that position is very much related to not believing in any kind of creator God. If you don't believe in a self, a permanent, fixed self, then how can you believe in a God that's as an agent, a creator, a being, permanent being? And similarly, you can't really buy into the notion of a soul, because that's also a permanent entity. The interviewer asks, how do Buddhists think of other religions? On the one hand, there seems to be a tolerance and even an appreciation for a diversity of views. On the other hand, there is a strong history of missionary activity aimed at conversion. Well, this is where the Zen tradition steps off the bus, because there is no such thing in Zen that I've ever heard of. We have no aim to convert anyone. There is no proselytizing in Zen. But there does seem to have been a lot of that going on in early Buddhism, where the monks in their wanderings across northern India would feel obliged to preach the Dharma, to use an old word, to preach. There is no preaching as such in Zen, but in those days, and there was. And he makes the point. he says, Buddhism has always been missionary. Buddhists have always thought that their doctrine and practices can help to alleviate suffering, and so have urged others to accept them. So people who squirm at the thought of proselytizing should at least consider that if you believe that it's going to help other people, then, I mean, trying to understand it from their point of view, they would say, well, this is the Dharma, is the way to liberation. It's the way to free ourselves from suffering. Why should I wait for others to ask me to preach the Dharma? It's my obligation to go to initiate it. But in Zen, we feel strongly, we strongly believe that whereas teaching, I'm not going to use that word preach, that teaching the Dharma has a place in response to expressed interest. It's not something that really will help someone much if we just buttonhole them and try to sell them on the Dharma. And that's our position, as historically, is that if someone inquires about Zen, let's say, then yes, we are obligated to respond to that inquiry. But it depends on how serious the inquiry is, as far as the extent of our response. People can ask in the most casual and in superficial way about it. They're just, and maybe they're people who they feel stuck with you at a cocktail party, and they're fishing around for something to make conversation. So maybe they ask, "Oh, what's Zen?" That's not something you want to take any time to answer. But if they persist and you sense that this is something they've heard of Zen, you know, they've seen it in any of the 500 commercial products that are out there, and they want to take advantage of this amazing encounter with a Zen Buddhist and want to ask what it is, well, give them a little something, but not too much. Watch them as you're answering them. Watch them. See their responses. See if their eyes are wandering off and much less rolling. Go from there. It's better to be very moderate in responding to questions like that than burying them in Zen doctrine. But here too, I have to object to this Professor Garfield is saying that Buddhism has always been missionary. Yeah, it used to be a lot more than now, but in Zen, it's not at all. But back to the question, what do we think, what do Buddhists think of other religions? He says, the Abrahamic religions all prohibit syncretism. Syncretism is the melding of beliefs from different creeds. But this is not a common feature of world religious traditions. Many Buddhists are syncretic to some degree. And then, for examples, he says in Japan, it is common to practice both Buddhism and Shinto. By the way, let me just pause here. It was surprising to me when I went to Japan and spent 6 months there to find how, first of all, that a lot of people had no idea what Zen was. That just blew my mind. I always equated Zen and Japan. But I just had a few brief discussions with people in public places, and they asked, you know, why I was dressed the way I was, and I said, you know, I'm into Zen, and they said, well, what's Zen? Just complete blank. The Japanese see no conflict with being both, considering themselves both Buddhist and Shinto. Shinto is the native ancient creed in Japan. There's a Roshi Kaplow used to say that in Japan, there's a saying, you get married in a Shinto service and you get buried in a Buddhist service, or you have a Buddhist funeral. And then he offers a couple other examples. In Nepal, many adopt Buddhist and Hindu practices. In China, Taoism, Confucianism, and Buddhism blend happily. And Thomas Merton was a Catholic priest and a Buddhist practitioner. And then the interviewer, I can see Buddhist missionaries making an attractive case for their practices of meditation and their ethics of compassion, but the doctrine of rebirth, which, if true, would make a huge difference in how we view human existence, seems very implausible. How do Buddhists defend this doctrine? And then the professor says, once again, there is diversity here. Some Buddhists don't defend the doctrine at all. This would be my advice. If someone challenges you about rebirth as part of Buddhism, you don't need to defend it. You don't need to believe it. Some Buddhists don't defend the doctrine at all, either because they take it to be the obvious default position, as it is in some Asian cultures, or because it is not important or taken seriously, as in some East Asian or Western traditions. But others do defend it. I think this is what distinguishes, what distinguishes Zen Buddhism from Tibetan Buddhism. One of the things that distinguishes it is that there's a lot less talk in Zen about rebirth than in Tibetan Buddhism. In Zen, it's much more of an emphasis on the present. Where is your mind now? Is it here or somewhere else? Are you aware and alert now to what's happening now, this present moment, or are you somewhere else? This Professor Garfield, who's being interviewed, he says one popular approach to defending it is an empirical argument that some people have clear memories of past lives or make clear and accurate predictions about their next lives. I don't see that's a very strong argument at all. We know, especially as we get older, how unreliable our memories are and how we can fabricate all kinds of things that we believe as memories of actual events. And he says, one sees this primarily in the Tibetan tradition, in which there is a widespread practice of identifying rebirths and of rebirth lineages for high lamas, such as the Dalai Lama. Yeah, so some of you know that when a Dalai Lama... Dalai Lama is a term that doesn't refer to just the current one, but there have been many Dalai Lamas in Tibetan history, and the idea is that when a Dalai Lama dies, as they all do, that then there is a period, usually 2 or 3 or 4 years later, where these high lamas go off in search of who the reborn Dalai Lama might be, and they have these tests where they lay out implements from the previous Dalai Lama when he was alive. They lay them out in front of the child, and the child supposedly chooses which ones were the actual Dalai Lamas and which ones were the control objects. That thing always seemed like a stretch to me. Just because it's not, I have no doubt about rebirth, but that it's so institutionalized that they always manage to find some child that can supposedly identify all these things correctly. Maybe, who knows? Maybe it's true. It seems just a bit of a hard to believe. And then the interviewer says, I suspect that people not already culturally disposed to accept rebirth aren't likely to find such evidence convincing. And then Garfield says, another approach is that of the Indian philosopher Dharmakirti, who argues for the necessity of believing in rebirth, though not directly for its reality. Dharmakirti argues that given the stupendous difficulty of achieving full awakening, the cultivation of a genuine aspiration to achieve awakening requires one to believe in future lives. Otherwise, one could not have the confidence in the possibility of success necessary to genuine resolution. Well, there's something to this, isn't there? That if you can accept the possibility, you don't have to believe it, but the possibility that birth is not a beginning and death is not an end, if you can be open to that possibility, then you've got a lot of time in which to accomplish what you aspire to. And if it helps you get less nutsy about coming to awaken in this lifetime, then that's good. You see this in Chinese Zen texts more than the Japanese Zen texts I've seen. In China, some of these great masters who I read from in Taisho occasionally, they will say something to the effect of, what isn't accomplished in this lifetime will be resumed in the next one. Just as, and they use the analogy, work that is not finished at the end of the workday can be taken up and finished the next day. Well, I suppose the danger there is that you can think, okay, whatever, I'm going to live a billion more lives, then I'll get around to it next time. But I don't think many people think that way. I tend to think that it can be kind of helpful to see time and see our life, capital L, is extending into the infinite future, and that we do the best we can, and then we pick it up again next time around. And we're not starting, if you believe in rebirth, you're not starting from scratch next time around. You're not starting from square one. And then just a couple more points here. He says the aspiration for awakening need not and should not, for a Mahayana Buddhist, be personalized. This goes back to something earlier in the interview about making this too much about oneself as an individual. Just as a stonemason building the ground floor of a medieval cathedral might aspire to its completion, even if he knows he'll not personally be around to be involved in its completion, a practitioner who aspires that awakening will be achieved need not believe that she will be around to see it, but only hope that her own conduct and practice will facilitate that. Amen. This broad and generous view of time reminds me of Buddhist practice of planting trees. So if we're planting a tree, unless we're very young, if we're planting a tree, say an oak tree, a big deciduous tree, if we're planting it, we know we're not going to see that as a mature tree. But still, we plant it for others. He then says, this suggests one way for a Buddhist not taken with the idea of personal rebirth across biological lives to take that doctrine as a useful metaphor. Treat the past reflectively and with gratitude and responsibility, and with an awareness that much of our present life is conditioned by our collective past. Take the future seriously as something we have the responsibility to construct, just as much as if we would be there personally. This makes sense of the ideas of intergenerational justice, or of collective contemporary responsibility for harms inflicted in the past, like racism, as well as our current personal responsibility to future generations, such as global warming. As Buddhism takes root in the West and as Asian Buddhist traditions engage with modernity, we will see how doctrines such as this persist, fade, or are adapted. One thing we can see from the long and multicultural history of Buddhism is that it has always deeply affected the cultures into which it has moved and has always been transformed in important ways by those cultures. So, speaking of planting trees, we've planted the Dharma in this country. We're not going to be around to see very far into the future and how it grows. At least we're not going to be around in this present body-mind complex. Certainly... This culture, this American culture it already has been affected by Buddhist teaching, but it'll continue to be probably more and more. One last thing. The interviewer says, won't the fundamental denial of a self be hard to maintain in the face of the modern emphasis on individuality? Well, here too, I haven't read the whole Buddhist canon, but I've read in several places that the Buddha never denied a self, just in those simple terms. He never said there is no self. What he said was there is no fixed, permanent self. It's just there too. It depends on how you define self. But the interview is asking a very obvious question with the American worship of the individual self. Won't this be very hard for us to swallow? And by the way, I think it is. I think it's the hardest thing for Americans about Buddhist Zen doctrine. But Garfield says, I don't think so. For one thing, note that the view that there is no substantial self, that's better. The interviewer had it wrong, but Garfield clarifies it. The view that there is no substantial self has a history in the West as well, in the thought of Hume and of Nietzsche. For another, note that many contemporary cognitive scientists and philosophers have either rejected the view that there is such a self or have defended some variety of a minimalistic conception of the self. So that would be like the self as that in us which has some relative continuity, our body minds, our appearance, our habit forces. So the doctrine isn't as secure in the non-Buddhist world as one might think. Well, that would be that's heartening to hear that, because there's so much misery that we inflict on ourselves and others through this attachment to the notion of a fixed self. Our time is up. We'll stop now and recite the four vows.